You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is E.L. Doctorow, the author, most recently, of The Waterworks, the author, of course, of Ragtime and Welcome to Hard Times and World's Fair and Lives of the Poets and Billy Bathgate. And I wanted to begin peculiarly. I suppose it's not fair to talk about a book that in some of its trappings is a gothic thriller, but it seems to me that many of the reviewers who've been writing about it, out of an old-fashioned fear of telling the end of A Penny Dreadful, are not really considering the moral values of the tale being told, and therefore they talk about it as allegorical without being willing to say allegorical of what. So I thought I'd begin by asking you about Dr. Sartorius and how you came to invent him.
About 10 years ago, I wrote a small dream piece of about 3 pages called The Waterworks, which I published in The Lives of the Poets. In this story, a man is standing on the embankment of a reservoir, and he's watching a model boat going through the waves, and a child's toy boat. And it capsizes and sinks, and he rushes into the adjoining reservoir and sees the owner of the boat, a miniature, as is said in the story, like the boat, a boy who's been drowned and whose body is slamming against the sluice gates. The child's body is recovered from the water. He wraps it up somehow and rushes off with it, leaving a second man who's observed this entire thing to wonder what was going on and what exactly was happening. And as I wondered when the story was finished, when you finish something, you're usually rid of it. It's a form of exorcism that takes place if you do it properly. And apparently I hadn't quite finished with this piece. And I worried about it and wondered about it for several years. I wrote World's Fair and then came back to thinking about it. Then I wrote Billy Bathgate, came back again, and finally I guess it was time to write the book. What I deduced was that this had to be a 19th century story because the transporting of water was the great accomplishment of that period, bringing it to the city, putting water under pressure. And then, for some reason, I've always associated waterworks with the Croton Aqueduct and the Croton Dam upstate New York. And then I recall that there indeed in New York City had been a reservoir at 42nd Street and 5th Avenue, an Egyptian revival monument, very odd, right in what is now the middle of the city where the New York Public Library stand. So I had my period and I had my city. The two men in the story, the man who wraps the child's body up and rushes off with it, turned out to be Dr. Sartorius, and the other man, the observer, became my narrator, McElvain.
It's funny because when I read the Waterworks story, it seemed as if that figure was the police detective Dunn, at least as he originally appeared to narrate the story. He refers to the shrouded figure as my man, and he seems to be very much an apprehending officer.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. That's not the way it worked out in my mind. McElvain is the key to the book, I think, who is a reporter, an old newspaper man, who is in effect telling us 30 years later about the story he never wrote. And he does employ the help, enlists police captain Dunn, Edmund Dunn. Perhaps you're right. Maybe there's some, I split that fellow up into two, the apprehender and the observer, and turn him into two characters. That's quite possible. I'll have to read the original again to see.
Well, those stories in Lives of the Poets seemed so mysterious as they appear there, you know, shards. I think they've lived in readers' memories as well. And it's not exactly a surprise to find the Waterworks fleshed out. In fact, I'm surprised that others of those stories have not had.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I don't consider myself a story writer. I'm not unnatural to the form. And to make a brief confession here, most of those stories that turned out to be stories I thought were going to be novels. So you see, if I was methodical and wanted to organize myself, I would take every one of those stories in that book and make a novel out of it. I don't think that's going to happen. The first piece in that book, The Writer and the Family, did give me the sense that I could write a book about that milieu and that particular family, which turned out to be World's Fair. So that's two of those pieces which have yielded further work. But the point about the waterworks is that it's a it led me to thinking about New York City and the 19th century. And once I was on to this, you see, all I could see in New York was the 19th century. Every time I walked down a street, there was a 19th century building. And it became apparent to me that in this city that's usually torn down every 10 years or so and rebuilt, there's an enormous presence of that century still there, right there. The Central Park, the Jefferson Market Courthouse, the Cooper Union College, the Armory on 67th Street and Park Avenue, the row houses in Harlem, the tenements on the Lower East Side, they're all just there. And but not only that, the very shape of the streets, the construction of the layout, the landscape, that was all done in that period.
The way you're speaking, it sounds the way Poe sounds when he's writing in The Philosophy of Composition how he came to write The Raven, you know, that he needed a bird that could talk and that if it said something, it would have to say something eerie and the long vowel in Nevermore will be an eerie vowel and therefore, you know. Is that in fact the way this book was constructed?
I would never. Do you? D.H. Lawrence said, never trust the author, trust the book. It is true that when you, since we're all writers, when the book is done, we keep writing, even if we make up fictions about the book. This is the way I've fallen into talking about it. In fact, I never quite believed Poe. There seemed to me some
I've never either.
determination there to react to what he thought was the dandyish kind of poetry that was around him and the affectation and the aestheticism of it. And he wanted to make poetry hard and practical and get rid of people like Longfellow. That was really what he was up to, I think, in that piece. But it is true that once you're on to something, you could get very practical about the construction of a book, the composition of a book. Once you know what your premises are, you have to deliver on them. And so your editorial mind is functioning simultaneously along with your creative mind. At least it always has with me. But the book here, as all of them, begins with an image or something very, very evocative that just won't let go of you. The entire book then turns out to be, in a sense, a deduction or an exegesis of the story, trying to render the feelings I had when I wrote that story.
Now we're going to Sartorius, because the book, to me, seems constructed around him to a question of morality and ethics, and to ask the question, well, what if, in fact, the mad doctor of Frankenstein or Hawthorne's Rappaccini's Daughter were, in fact, to not be completely a madman, but to be a man more intelligent than those around him who has perhaps inched too far in his procedures. And as such, he seems to be, when he finally speaks, the most interesting man in the book. Yes, he's done coldly, but he does know what he's doing. You know what I mean? He's not a person who's escaping his own consequences.
No, hardly. He is a person who is simply doing what he's always done. During the Civil War, he has effected procedures and surgical procedures which have been of great benefit to the soldiers wounded soldiers. He developed post-operative therapies that have been adopted by the military medical establishment. And after the war, he's one of the sanitary commission doctors who helped prevent a cholera outbreak in New York City.
He reminds me a bit of that figure that Celine wrote his doctoral thesis on. Celine wrote about a doctor who insisted that doctors wash their hands before ministering to women giving birth and wash their hands afterwards. One delights in thinking of Celine requesting this kind of cleanliness. But
well, yes, that Sartorius is a projects himself through his intellect out beyond the realm of permissible behavior of the time. On the other hand, to speak in the other case, he is willing to accept the immense funding that he requires from old wealthy men who simply want to maintain themselves at the expense of their heirs and families. He also seems to accept the protection of the Tweed ring without acknowledging really that there are any moral issues at all to be thought about.
Well, it's an interesting thing because he appears in a novel and his ideas are theoretical. I thought about something you'd said about the artist, that an artist is a transgressor. And Sartorius seems, for better or worse, to be the transgressor in this book. In other words, he seems more than any of the others to be the artist figure, and decidedly so, since the artist will write announces that he's turned his back on art, that he doesn't care, in fact, about art. So he seemed a much more problematic figure still than simply ethically problematic.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's true. Part of the fascination of the character for me was the fact that he seems to elude any easy ascription. In fact, one of the things I realized in writing the book, and which I give to McIlvain, is that what he calls the villainy, all the villainy in the book is entirely elusive, and the villains in it you can never quite get your hands on them, whether it's old Pemberton, who is not seen really until he's dead, or Pemberton's factotum, who is found on the beach, or indeed Tweed himself, who is really not a major character in the book, but more or less a presence, like a configuration of the clouds, a kind of ethos that has settled on the city like some sort of fog, miasmic fog. Very elusive, and McIlvain says, and you reach out to grab these people, and your hand hits the mirror. And the elusiveness of Dr. Sartorius, if he is indeed a villain, is his intellectual point of view, which does not recognize any easy journalistic, moralistic ascriptions.
Well, I thought that perhaps if he were an artist, he would be an artist that you might not entirely approve of. He would be an art for art's sake kind of artist, uninterested in the milieu, the actuality of the world he lives in, interested, like Valerie, perhaps, in what the mind can reasonably project.
I accept that analogy. I think that's a good one.
Well, I'm going to call in two big figures here, Valerie on the one hand and Walter Benjamin on the other. You've admired in different essays Benjamin's essay on the tale-teller and on the storyteller. And on the one hand, Valerie seems to be a worker in the ineffable. Benjamin says that the storyteller really is a craftsman, that the great virtue of the storyteller is that he seems to come from an artisan class and seems to come from the trades. And I wanted to I guess the thing that gives me most pleasure in the waterworks, in Ragtime, and in others, is the kind of consequent chronicle narration that Benjamin sees as being very much the result of someone who cares about where he lives near, but who's also traveled far and bringing news back to the people he's telling stories to. I wanted to talk to you about craftsmanship.
Well, you know, he's talking in that, he's talking about oral storytelling, isn't he? The days before stories were written down, when craftsmen would move from village to village and sit with the local employer or fellow craftsmen as they worked together and bring the tale, and it would be told and retold and refined and polished and buffed just like whatever piece they were working on. But if you ask me what my sense of the calling is, I take great pleasure in thinking of it as a kind of trade, of thinking of myself as getting up to going to work in the morning like everybody else. I certainly have never been a Valéry-esque figure. And in terms of my own personal life, I've lived very ordinary, average kind of domesticated existence. Which I think Flaubert also suggested is the way to get your work done.
Live like a bourgeois.
That's right.
But Benjamin also talks about how, in the course of this polishing of the tale through retelling, a mystery arises, perhaps because things in retellings of stories have now been left out, cleaned up, dropped away, become irrelevant historically. And so you have almost an image from which psychology has been subtracted. In order to understand the story, you might want to add psychology, but you'd be doing it on your own some. And it struck me, too, that in your work, is well, obviously in what you've called the dream pieces and lives of the poets, but that there is an interest in a sort of image mystery, which psychology might help to explain, but the fiction seems to be rather uninterested in that kind of inner process.
Well, images are what always evoke the beginnings of books for me. Sounds of words, images, even phrases of music. The slightest private excitements are always the origins of books. And certainly the image of the toy boat going down the reservoir generated something clearly for me in my mind. And I like the idea of an image standing on its own and sort of shimmering for one and having some meaning which must be elucidated, which must be sought out and worked on by the reader or the hearer. It's interesting because in this century, the techniques of fiction have been adopted by the social sciences to a great degree. There are even historians now who write turning to fiction. And in a sense, I think of psychology as the industrialization of storytelling. They have all these interchangeable parts that can be applied to any one of us. But if you're suggesting that somehow I honor whatever the ancient craft is, I'm very pleased about that. Benjamin, of course, said that the era of storytelling was over because we had now only the individual writers who could offer us no counsel or no wisdom, as the ancient storytellers could. I don't happen to subscribe to that part of the essay, I think.
Well, it seems to me that, in fact, that one of the things that you've adopted as the role of the writer is to offer counsel, that if anything, that the Benjamin advice that the writer has abjured his role as advisor to a culture is one that you've sought to redress in some sense.
Well, but avoiding any pieties that might or grandiosity of the role you might pick for yourself. This is nothing I've ever consciously chosen to do. I think any ideas you have, any convictions, any beliefs have to come up organically out of the work. You must honor the process, and you can't inflict on it and expect it to survive any kind of sort of hard intention. That's the surest way to destroy anything.
The image that kept coming to me through many of the things in Waterworks, also in Lives of the Poets, but throughout your work, is the image of parents eating their young, letting an older generation, letting a younger generation go hungry, uneducated, untransformed by the knowledge of a previous generation. It almost as if on every level, either people will accept being orphaned and teach themselves, but if they turn to their own progenitors, they're not going to get what they need. On the other hand, to write a book like The Waterworks, one does turn to a previous generation of writers and teach oneself, I guess slowly, to write their sentences. So I wondered about you and forebears.
It is true that I think every book is an answer to some other book, that the conversation or the communication a writer has is not only with his readers, not only on a contemporary lateral line, but with the past, always with the past, as if there are all these people sitting around in some wonderful eventless heaven talking to each other. And to the extent that you use a literary convention, whether you're aware of it or not, as I seem to have done in this book, I am responding as a hopeful child to Hawthorne and to Melville, to Poe, and maybe even to Edith Wharton. But yes, there's no question about it. Whether this could be described as a state of orphanage, I'm not sure. There seem to be a lot of children in the books, one way or another, and the image, I think what McIlvain says in The Waterworks is accepting some sort of Darwinian principle that although it's being argued on the church in the sermons and among the intellectuals, nevertheless governs, as new as it is, if it is new, the lives of the city, where everyone seems to be quite willing to sustain losses for the progress of the city. And so there are 30,000-40,000 vagrant children running around, most of whom are going to end up disastrously, or there's no social policy that does anything about the veterans who have no arms or legs and that kind of thing, that we seem to be able to accept, even in our own day, enormous losses among our fellow citizens and for our own comfort. And there doesn't seem to be any way we can master, even in this post-Cold War enlightenment, the great domestic problems that, if they are problems, if you want to use that terrible political word, that afflict us. In that sense, the idea of orphanage, you see, becomes a very important kind of governing image of this book. But myself, in terms of having these masters to rely on, whether consciously or not, it's just the opposite of being an orphan. It's mm-hmm. it's having a wonderful community of parents.
Well, that's why I started to sense, in fact, that someone recently said to me that there is no culture without altruism. I tend to think that the masters, whether it's Melville or Hawthorne, and Melville, you know, toward the end of his life, impoverished and insane, but still someone of whom his own little scrawled note remained true, stay true to the dreams of your youth, that as opposed to the literary masters, the old men in the waterworks are people who want to ensure their own lives in a permanent moment and care nothing for their own children or the children of strangers, that there is, in selfishness, a refusal to see to the children. A sense that a generation of writers are abandoning children or are no longer being good masters. Somehow, the sense that the culture is not continuing itself, cannot, or has stopped in some way, that transmission has ended, and that what there is instead the transmission of selfishness from one generation to the next.
Well, certainly there are political implications of that sort. The book does speak very clearly in terms of an attempt to invert the natural order of succession and of primogeniture and of one of the sons succeeding the fathers, very explicitly that appeared during the past presidential election. This generation of Bill Clintons that came up in the 60s was long ago thought to be totally unreliable and untrustworthy and not deserving of the mantle of power. And that was quite clear in the conflict between, in the debates between those two men. Every president since Eisenhower, I suppose, having been until now, having been that of that World War II generation, and terribly shocked by the great anti-war uprising of their sons. So this does operate clearly. It may be, though, in general, large social terms, a loss of any kind of real communal, serious and sincere communal ideal. Something has deteriorated from the way I think it used to be, although that might be an unwarranted sentimentality. But it just seems to me that in the past, when things were bad, there was always a sense that, well, this should be, something should be done about this. And I'm not sure that there's something that should be done about this survives the political process today.
Thank you. I've been speaking to E.L. Doctorow. Thank you for being with us today. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.